Good afternoon, everybody. Nice to see you. Somebody asked apparently to do the Majjhima Nikaya 38 today, the Mahatanha Sankhya Sutta. But I think the person who asked for it is not here, which is a bit interesting. Yeah. So, but I think that now I have all the photocopies and everything ready for it, I might as well do that sutta. And I've also looked at a sutta myself, so it's probably a good thing to do. Lynn, do you want to pass this on? Yeah. Okay. It's a fairly sort of heavy sutta, deep sutta, if you like. There's a lot of things about dependent origination here and other things. So fairly profound and difficult doctrine, some of it. So I wasn't sure whether it was the right thing to do, but since it was asked for, I thought we could do it. But anyway, so Majjhima 38, page 349, in the middle-length sayings. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Blessed One was living at Savati in Jeta's grove and at Apindika's park. Now, on that occasion, a pernicious view had arisen in a bhikkhu named Sati, son of a fisherman, thus: as I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the round of rebirths, not another. So what he's saying here is that consciousness is a permanent entity which runs around samsara, and that this permanent entity, that is like a self in a sense. So he has an idea that consciousness is a self, is something permanent. And that's the problem with this view, because according to Buddhism, there is nothing permanent, of course, in the five khandhas. Several bhikkhus, having heard about this, went to the bhikkhu Sati and asked him, "Friend Sati, is it true that such a pernicious view has arisen in you?" "Exactly so, friends. As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through the round of rebirths, not another." Then those bhikkhus, desiring to detach him from that pernicious view, pressed and questioned and cross-questioned him thus: "Friend Sati, do not say so. Do not misrepresent the Blessed One. It is not good to misrepresent the Blessed One. The Blessed One would not speak thus. For in many ways the Blessed One has stated consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition there is no origination of consciousness. Yet, although pressed and questioned and cross-questioned by those bhikkhus in this way, the bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, still obstinately adhered to that pernicious view and continued to insist upon it. Since the bhikkhus were unable to detach him from that pernicious view, they went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, they sat down at one side and told him all that had occurred, adding, "Venerable Sir, since we could not detach the bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, from that pernicious view, we have reported this matter to the Blessed One." Then the Blessed One addressed a certain bhikkhu thus: "Come, bhikkhu, tell the bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, in my name that the teacher calls him." "Yes, Venerable Sir," he replied, and he went to the bhikkhu Sati and told him, "The teacher calls you, friend Sati." "Yes, friend," he replied, and he went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, sat down at one side. The Blessed One then asked him, "Sati, is it true that the following pernicious view has arisen in you? As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is the same consciousness that runs and wanders through the round of rebirths, not another." "Exactly so, Venerable Sir. As I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One, it is this same consciousness that runs and wanders through this round of rebirths, not another." "What is that consciousness, Sati?" "Venerable Sir, it is that which speaks and feels and experiences here and there the results of good and bad actions." So he's just confirming there that it is just the ordinary consciousness that a person has, that he is saying here is permanent. The right reply there would probably have been something like, it is the stream of consciousness which keeps going on from life to life. If he had said that, then of course that would have been the right answer there. Misguided man, to whom have you ever known me to teach the Dhamma in that way? Misguided man, have I not stated in many ways consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition there is no origination of consciousness? But you, misguided man, have misrepresented us by your wrong grasp, and injured yourself and stored up much demerit, for this will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time. Then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus thus, Bhikkhus, what do you think? Has this bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, kindled even a spark of wisdom in this Dhamma and discipline? How could he, Venerable Sir? No, Venerable Sir. When this was said, the bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, sat silent, dismayed, with shoulders drooping, head down, glum, and without response. Then, knowing this, the Blessed One told him, Misguided man, you will be recognized by your own pernicious view. I shall question the bhikkhus on this matter. Interesting here that he says that he has made a lot of demerit. And I think that demerit that he has made is not so much the fact that he has this view necessarily, but the main reason that he has made a lot of demerit here and stored up much bad karma is because he's claiming that this is the Buddha's teaching here. He's saying this is the Buddha's teaching, despite the fact that the Buddha is actually teaching the exact opposite. And this is the reason here, it seems, that he's making so much demerit in this case. Yes, sir. Sorry? He could have the wrong view because he had the wrong view from the beginning? I suspect that he was probably just... maybe he had some view that was a residual view from maybe an earlier teacher or an earlier instructions he had before he became a Buddhist, maybe. So he must have... Or maybe he was taking somebody else as a teacher outside the Buddhist dispensation. I don't know why he had it, but it's obviously quite contrary to the Buddha's teaching. It depends on the situation. I mean, if you really believe that it is the Buddha's teaching and you have investigated it and you believe something is the Buddha's teaching and you do it in good faith, then it's not necessarily bad karma, but if you're told by other monks and everybody that this is actually wrong view and you don't take any heed and you sort of insist that this is right and that not everything else is wrong, you know, that then of course it becomes worse. So it depends on how much, you know, it's good to be a little bit sort of humble, that not sort of insist that you're right in the face of all the evidence, if all the evidence is contrary. Sometimes it's just a matter of attachment. You're so attached to a view because you'd like there to be something there. You know, I want to be something. And that might be the reason, basically. But it's good to question, of course. You shouldn't just, you know, this sounds like it's not good to question, but that's obviously not the case either. Okay. And it's interesting here. He says that he hasn't even kindled a spark of wisdom in this Dhamma and discipline. And obviously the reason for that is that it's one of the main, most important things in the Dhamma is the idea of impermanence and non-self. And he's basically saying here the exact opposite, that there's something permanent, and essentially there is a self, and the self is consciousness. That's what he's saying here. Okay, so then the Blessed One addresses the monks. Bhikkhus, do you understand the Dhamma taught by me as this Bhikkhu Sati, son of a fisherman, does, when he represents us by his wrong when he misrepresents us by his wrong grasp and injures himself and stores up much demerit. No, venerable sir, for in many discourses the Blessed One has stated consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition there is no origination of consciousness. Good bhikkhus, it is good that you understand the Dhamma taught by me thus, for in many ways have I stated consciousness to be dependently arisen, since without a condition there is no origination of consciousness. But this bhikkhusati, son of a fisherman, misrepresents us by his wrong grasp and injures himself and stores up much demerit, for this will lead to the harm and suffering of this misguided man for a long time. Okay, now we move on to the conditionality of consciousness. Bhikkhus, consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent upon which it arises. When consciousness arises dependent on the eye and forms, it is reckoned as eye consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the ear and sounds, it is reckoned as ear consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the nose and odors, it is reckoned as nose consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the tongue and flavors, it is reckoned as tongue consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the body and tangibles, it is reckoned as body consciousness. When consciousness arises dependent on the mind and mind object, it is reckoned as mind consciousness. So the point here is that, first of all, consciousness actually arises. It comes into existence due to eye and form, nose and odor, etc. So something which arises all the time, not something which is always there. Sometimes it seems that because of awareness, we're always there looking at things. But actually, consciousness arises each time depending on the object. That's the first lesson to see here. But the second lesson here is that there are actually six different types of consciousness here. And these consciousness are different. So if you have very, very sharp mindfulness, you can actually see that there is like you have different consciousness from one moment to the next. So in other words, there's no continuity of awareness, no continuity of consciousness from one object to the next one. There is just eye consciousness, and then there is ear consciousness, and they are different. It's like apple and pears, or apples and bananas. But when you see that, you realize that this is not the same thing. This is not like a continuity there. These are discrete moments, things changing from one moment to the next one. But the reason why it appears that you have this continuation is because after each sense consciousness, there is a moment of mind consciousness. Excuse me. And the mind consciousness takes each sense consciousness as its own object. So, for example, you have a moment of eye consciousness, and then immediately after that, the mind also takes that eye conscious, that same object, or a mind object which is derived from the eye consciousness, it takes in the mind. And then you have like a nose consciousness. Then the mind can take an object derived from that nose consciousness, it takes as its own object in the mind. So everything always refers back to the mind. So because it always refers back to the mind, there is a sense of continuity there, when in fact the different consciousnesses are actually separate and different. So there is an illusion of continuity. You have to have very sharp, extremely sharp mindfulness. That's why you need such deep samadhi and things to be able to see these things, that they're actually is actually discrete. It's not continuous. Excuse me. Okay, so and then we have a simile to describe this. Just as a fire is reckoned by the particular condition dependent on which it burns, when fire burns dependent on logs, it is reckoned as a log fire. When the fire burns dependent on faggots, it is reckoned as a faggot fire. When the fire burns dependent on grass, it is reckoned as a grass fire. When fire burns dependent on cow dung, it is reckoned as a cow dung fire. When fire burns dependent on chaff, it is reckoned as a chaff fire. when fire burns dependent on rubbish, it is reckoned as a rubbish fire. So too, consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition dependent on which it arises. When consciousness arises dependent on the I and form, etc., it is reckoned as I consciousness. And when it arises dependent on mind and mind objects, it is reckoned as mind consciousness. So that is just showing the conditionality of consciousness and how consciousness is not something which is just permanent and is always there, unchanging, but something which changes all the time. Okay, then the Buddha continues, Bhikkhus, do you see this has come to be? Yes, Venerable Sir. Bhikkhus, do you see its origination occurs with that as nutriment? Yes, Venerable Sir. Bhikkhus, do you see with the cessation of that nutriment, there has come, what has come to be is subject to cessation? Yes, Venerable Sir. Okay. This is a bit cryptic, this passage, at least straight away. Huh? So this has come to be, this here is I think first of all he's obviously referring back to consciousness, which was talked about just before. This has come to be, in other words, this is something which has arisen. It has come to be because of cause and conditions. But I think more broadly, we're probably talking about also here, I think the commentary says that too, we're talking about all the five aggregates here. So this has come to be simply means that this person has come to be. These five aggregates have come to be. In other words, there's nothing permanent there. They have arisen from something. This is what is meant here, it seems. So do you see this has come to be? And they say, yes, Venerable Sir. Because do you see its origination occurs with that as nutriment? So this is like the second noble truth here. This is talking about origination of things, how things come into existence. So a nutriment here is a particular term which is used in the suttas as a condition for things to exist. And we're coming on to nutriments afterwards, but in short, there's a group called the four nutriments in the suttas, and they are like physical food, contact, volition of the mind, and consciousness are these four nutriments. So basically, the five aggregates come into origination, arise due to these four nutriments. And but the thing is that these four nutriments, again, they are dependent on craving. Yeah? So of course, craving is much more well-known. Craving is always the cause in the Second Noble Truth. So what we're seeing here, we're seeing that craving, in a sense, gives rise to the four nutriments. And then the four nutriments are what keeps the five aggregates going. So its origination occurs with that as nutriment. Basically, the five khandhas are kept going by craving. This is what they are saying here, basically. Yes, Venerable Sir, we see this. Because, do you see, with the cessation of that nutriment, what has come to be is subject to cessation. So again, this is the third noble truth, right? With the cessation of that nutriment, well, that nutriment ultimately is reducible to craving. So because it is reducible to craving, with the cessation of craving, eventually the five khandhas come to cease because of that. So what we're seeing here is that when craving ceases, then the five aggregates cease. This is what it is meant here. So basically, this paragraph 9 there is the first three of the Four Noble Truths. This has come to be, five aggregates, this is like dukkha, its origination is craving, and then you have the cessation afterwards. So the first three of the Four Noble Truths. And you will see also another interesting thing in that particular paragraph, because the Buddha asks the monks, Bhikkhus, do you see? And this seeing in Pali is the word passati, and passati passanaha is basically seeing with insight. So when the bhikkhus here are answering, yes, we see, essentially they are saying that we are, at least we are stream enterers, because we have right view, we're actually seeing this as it really is. So this is almost like an affirmation here of stream entry when they say, yes, Venerable Sir. And this becomes even more clear further down. Excuse me. Bhikkhus, does doubt arise when one is uncertain thus? Has this come to be? Yes, Venerable Sir. Bhikkhus, does doubt arise when one is uncertain thus? Does its origination occur with that as nutriment? Yes, Venerable Sir. Bhikkhus, does doubt arise when one is uncertain thus? With the cessation of that nutriment, is what has come to be subject to cessation? Yes, Venerable Sir. So here he is talking about somebody who is not an Arya, somebody not a Sotapanna, and they haven't seen the Four Noble Truths for themselves. And because they haven't seen that, they're going to have doubt about these things. They're not really going to be sure about it. So anybody who hasn't seen it is going to have doubts about these things. That's just the nature of it. Because is doubt abandoned in one who sees as it actually is with proper wisdom thus? This has come to be. Yes, Venerable Sir. Because is doubt abandoned in one who sees as it actually is with proper wisdom thus? Its origination occurs with that as nutriment? Yes, Venerable Sir. Because is doubt abandoned in one who sees as it actually is with proper wisdom thus? With the cessation of that nutriment, what has come to be is subject to cessation. Yes, Venerable Sir. And here, basically here, we're just saying that when you become an Arya, you become at least a stream enterer, then you abandon doubt in regard to these three noble truths. And you know for yourself these truths directly by through insight. Because are you thus free from doubt here? This has come to be? Yes, Venerable Sir. Because are you thus free from doubt here? Its origination occurs with that as nutriment? Yes, Venerable Sir. Because are you thus free from doubt here? With the cessation of that nutriment, what has come to be is subject to cessation? Yes, Venerable Sir. So this is just like a reinforcement that they are all, or certainly those monks who answer in the affirmative there, they are all stream enterers at least. Because has it been well seen by you as it actually is with proper wisdom thus? This has come to be. No, I'm reading again what I just read. Yeah. Because purified and bright as this view is, if you adhere to it, cherish it, treasure it, and treat it as a possession. Would you then understand that the Dhamma has been taught as similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping? No, Venerable Sir. Because purified and bright as this view is, if you do not adhere to it, cherish it, treasure it, and treat it as a possession, would you then understand the Dhamma, that the Dhamma has been taught as similar to a raft, being for the purpose of crossing over, not for the purpose of grasping? Yes, Venerable Sir. So here he is just saying that we should be careful in grasping views, even views which are right views. Because presumably what he might be referring to here is that if you have too strong grasp of anything, you're going to argue about it, you're going to get into all sorts of troubles and problems. So the right way is just to use that view and see it as right view, but not sort of, I presume, tenaciously grasp onto it in a sense that you argue about it and you create all sorts of problems for yourself and others. Nutriment and dependent origination. Because there are these four kinds of nutriment for the maintenance of beings that already have come to be and for the support of those seeking a new existence. What for? They are physical food as nutriment, gross or subtle, contact as second, mental volition as third, consciousness as the fourth. Okay, so these are the nutriments that they were speaking about just before, these four nutriments. And how is it that these four things are nutriments for beings then? Okay, so the first thing to realize, of course, that physical food obviously is a nutriment for the physical body. And the reason that you have gross and subtle there is that gross food is probably what we eat, and subtle would be food that the devas eat, for example. So you have gross and subtle physical food. Contact is the second. Well, contact, the reason contact is there is because without contact you can't have any feeling. Feeling is dependent on contact. It's the contact through the six senses that give rise to feeling. And of course, feeling is one of is necessary, because if there's no feeling, there is also no consciousness. Consciousness and feeling always go together in Buddhism. So you have to have contact. Contact gives rise to feeling in Buddhism. Mental volition. Mental volition, essentially, this is kamma. So this is what gives rise to rebirth, if you like. This is what gives rise to consciousness getting stationed in a new place in a future life. So mental volition here is what makes rebirth, what allows for rebirth, allows for consciousness to actually establish itself in the future. And the last here, consciousness. Well, consciousness is necessary for the body as well. Consciousness is necessary for all the other mental factors. The body and the mental factors is sometimes called together mentality and materiality, or name and form, more simply. And it's interesting, in the suttas you have that name and form, which is like the form aspect, the bodily aspect of things, and the name aspect is like all the mental qualities apart from consciousness. This name and form depends on consciousness, and consciousness depends on this name and form. And according to the sutta, which has a simile of the reed in it, is that name and form and consciousness is like two reeds which lean against each other, and if one falls over, the other one falls. So consciousness is necessary for name and form, and that is why consciousness is the fourth nutriment here. So these are the four things which are necessary for there to be life, basically, for there to be the five khandhas. And that is how they come to be necessary here. Now, bhikkhus, these four kinds of nutriment have what as the source, what as the origin, from what are they born and produced? And these four kinds of nutriments have craving as their source, craving as the origin. They are born and produced from craving here. So here, we are, just like what I mentioned before, is that we are talking, it's craving basically here, which is the most important aspect. And in most suttas, you will just see that craving is the cause of the five khandhas. But here they put this middle term in between, which they call the four nutriments, just to add, add another layer of explanation there. This craving has what as its source? Craving has feeling as its source. And this feeling has what as its source? Feeling has contact as its source. And this contact has what as its source? Contact has a sixfold base as its source. And this sixfold base has what as its source? The sixfold base has mentality, materiality as its source. And this mentality, materiality has what as its source? Mentality, materiality has consciousness as its source. And this consciousness has what as its source? Consciousness has formations as its source. And these formations have what as the source? What as the origin? From what are they born and produced? Formations have ignorance as the source. Ignorance as the origin. They are born and produced from ignorance. And of course there you can see that that's the dependent origination there, going from craving back to ignorance. And a lot of this which comes up now is about dependent origination. And after having read the next paragraph, I will explain a little bit more detail about this dependent origination. So this is the forward exposition on the rising of dependent origination. So, bhikkhus, with ignorance as conditions, formations come to be. With formations as conditions, consciousness. with consciousness as condition, mentality, materiality. With mentality, materiality as condition, the sixfold base. With the sixfold base as condition, contact. With contact as condition, feeling. With feeling as condition, craving. With craving as condition, clinging. With clinging as condition, being. With being as condition, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. Okay, so this is dependent origination that we have here. And it's probably useful to maybe explain this in a little bit detail, because it's far from clear what this means unless you have some understanding here. So the most important thing with dependent origination is that it is an explanation for how suffering arises in the world. So the purpose of dependent origination, and that's why it ends with suffering, is to show the conditions that lead to suffering in the world. And you will see here that it is ignorance or avidya, lack of knowledge or delusion, if you like, which is the ultimate cause for suffering to arise in the world. So it gives you a structure. It explains the structure by which suffering exists in the world. And of course, once you understand that structure, then you can start to do something about it. Then you can untangle that structure and you can start to decide, well, what needs to be done to actually get rid of suffering, because suffering is comes through this particular structure here. So ignorance is the very first condition here. And the first link here is, with ignorance as condition, formations arise, or formations come to be. Okay, to understand this, first of all, we have to understand what ignorance means in this particular context. And ignorance in this particular context means the lack of understanding, the lack of insight into the Four Noble Truths. That's what ignorance is here. And formations here is nothing other than kamma, producing kamma. The production of kamma is what formations mean here. The Pali word is sankhara. And it basically means the production of kamma. That's what it comes down to. So that you produce kamma through the mind, through the speech, or through the body, right? Just ordinary kamma. That's all it means really here. Now, how is it that ignorance is a condition for production of kamma? How can that be here? Okay, the point here is that if you're ignorant, you don't understand the Four Noble Truths, right? So you don't understand what is suffering and what is not suffering. Because you don't understand that rebirth is suffering, you want to get reborn. Because you don't understand that all these other things, all the five khandhas are suffering, you want to re-establish yourself in the five khandhas. Because you want these things, you intend accordingly. You make intentions for getting reborn. You make intentions for indulging yourself in sensuality. You make intentions for rebirth. And of course, intention is kamma. You have the ancient teaching of the Buddha in the Anguttara Nikaya, which says, what is kamma? And he says that kamma is chaitana. Chaitana is kamma. In other words, intention, that chaitana, that volition of the mind, is kamma. So because you don't understand what ignorance is, you will tend to intend things which cause you don't understand what suffering is, you will do things because according to the Buddha, suffering, the five khandhas are suffering, but you don't understand that. You see the five khandhas as happiness instead. Your intentions will be to act so that you get the five khandhas in the future. You will want those five khandhas in the future. If you fully understood what suffering is, that suffering is the five khandhas, of course you wouldn't do anything. You wouldn't have any intentions for being reborn in the future. You wouldn't do anything which gives rise to rebirth in the future. So all those intentions would be cut off, and all you would have left would just be living life without any intentions for future rebirth whatsoever. So ignorance here is basically non-understanding of dukkha. Because you don't understand dukkha, you form intentions which lead to rebirth in the future. With formations as condition, consciousness arises. This, again, as I said, formations is basically here kamma. And because of kamma, consciousness arises in a new life in the future. The kamma obviously leads to rebirth. And that's what is being said here. With consciousness as condition, mentality, materiality. So once consciousness goes over the gap from one life to the next, then consciousness becomes a support for wherever consciousness descends. Consciousness descends in a new body somewhere, in a new life. Then consciousness becomes a support for that body in that new life. That is just the simile I said before of consciousness and mentality, materiality, leaning on each other and depending on each other. They both have to be there together. But consciousness is primary and as it comes from the previous life. With mentality, materiality as condition, there is the sixfold base. Well, the sixfold base is just the six senses in Buddhism. Sight, hearing, smell, touch, and taste, and of course the mind base. Soon as you have consciousness together with the body, then you also get the sixfold base. Once you have the sixfold base in place, there will be contact. Because once you have the eyes, etc., there, then of course you will start to see, and you will start to hear, and you will start to smell, etc. So that is contact. When you actually smell something, that's contact. When you contact something, when the eye and form meet together, then you will feel. You will feel either pleasure or displeasure, or you might feel something neutral. If you feel, then craving arises. The reason that craving arises, of course, is that if you feel something nice, you want more of it. If you feel something disagreeable, you want to get rid of it. If you feel something neutral, well, it will depend on your how spiritual maturity, how you react to it. With craving as condition, clinging. Clinging here is like an intensification of craving. Or sometimes clinging, this word upadana in Pali, is also translated as attachment. So this is like attaching. Once you crave, once you desire something, you will attach to things. You will start to hold on to them because of that craving. Another way of looking at it is as taking things up. For example, you crave for sensuality, you crave for sensual pleasures, and you will take things up. You will like take up eating nice food, you would take up going to the movies, you would take up doing all these things which are sensual. Or, if you get into deep meditation, you might even have some, you will start take up meditation. And that can also be a kind of taking up here, kind of clinging in a sense. It's a kind of a weak form of clinging, if you like, because you're taking up something which is pleasurable for you. Then, with clinging as condition, there is being. Okay, being here literally means existence. So, and this has to be understood in the sense that once you take something up, you take up a certain course of being, going to the movies, indulging in sensuality, or practicing meditation, or whatever it is, then in a sense, that is who you are. You become, in a sense, what you do. So you are creating, if you decide that you're going to lead a life of indulgence in sensual pleasures, then of course, that is in a sense, that's the kamma you're creating. You're creating kamma in that way, because you are taking up sensuality. So you're always creating kamma in that sense. And your mind and your entire being revolves around that sensuality. So that becomes your existence, so to speak. And because that is your existence, you tend always to create that kamma as well. And by creating that kamma, then in the future, you get reborn from that kamma. And that's why birth is a condition from being. Because you get reborn accordingly to what sort of existence you had in your past life. Then, with birth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. And such is the origination of this whole mass of suffering. If you get born, well, then you can expect aging and death, and all other sorts of suffering here. Okay, so that's just a brief overview of Paticchasamuppada. Yes, sir? Sorry?
I can't hear you, by the way. Yeah?
Neutrality here. You mean feeling here? You mean the feeling here? Right, okay, yeah. Neutral feeling is basically, if can be equanimity, yeah. Equanimity is one of them. There's also other types of neutral feelings. Any type of feeling which doesn't, any type of sense impact which doesn't give rise to pleasure or displeasure is a neutral one. But the highest form of neutral, of neutral feeling is equanimity, particularly the equanimity you have when you come out of the fourth jhana. That's a sort of the highest form of equanimity. Yeah, that is a, that's obviously very useful equanimity. Okay, reverse order questionnaire on arising. So what we saw before, just now, was the forward exposition of arising. It showed how from ignorance you get all the way to aging and death. Now this one here starts at the other end. It starts with aging and death and go backwards. And you might ask, well, what's the difference? And there isn't really any difference, except that when you start with aging and death, you are in a sense uncovering the conditions for why there is aging and death. So you are, it's more like an analysis of what's happening here. So you will find that when you read the suttas, you read what the Buddha did before he got fully enlightened. And he would review his life in this way. He would say, well, there is a problem here. It's called aging and death and suffering here. Now, what is the cause for that, aging and death? So it becomes an analysis. You start with a problem and you analyze your way back here. So this is why it is sometimes given in this reverse way, because it shows you how to analyze from the problem back to the cause, whereas the previous one was going from the cause to the problem. So with birth as condition, aging and death, so it was said. Now, bhikkhus, do aging and death have birth as condition or not? How do you take it in this case? Aging and death have birth as condition, venerable sir. Thus we take it in this case. With birth as condition, aging and death. With being as condition, birth, so it was said. Now, bhikkhus, does birth have being as condition or not? How do you take it in this case? Birth has being as condition, venerable sir. Thus we take it in this case. With being as condition, birth. With clinging as condition, being, so it was said. Now, bhikkhus, does being have clinging as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case? Being has clinging as condition, venerable sir. Thus we take it in this case. With clinging as condition, being. With craving as condition, clinging, so it was said. Now, bhikkhus, does clinging have craving as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case? Clinging has craving as condition, venerable sir. Thus we take it in this case. With craving as condition, clinging. With feeling as condition, craving, so it was said. Now, bhikkhus, does craving have feeling as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case? Craving has feeling as condition, venerable sir. Thus we take it in this case. With feeling as condition, craving. With contact as condition, feeling, so it was said. Now, bhikkhus, does feeling have contact as condition or not? How do you take it in this case? Feeling has contact as condition, venerable sir. Thus we take it in this case. With contact as condition, feeling. With the sixfold base as condition, contact, so it was said. Now, bhikkhus, does contact have the sixfold base as condition or not? How do you take it in this case? Contact has the sixfold base as condition, venerable sir. Thus we take it in this case. With the sixfold base as condition, there is contact. With mentality, materiality as condition, the sixfold base, so it was said. Now, bhikkhus, does the sixfold base have mentality, materiality as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case? The sixfold base has mentality, materiality as condition, venerable sir. Thus we take it in this case. With mentality, materiality as condition, the sixfold base. With consciousness as condition, mentality, materiality, so it was said. Now, bhikkhus, does mentality, materiality have consciousness as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case? Mentality, materiality has condition, consciousness as condition, venerable sir. Thus we take it in this case, with consciousness as condition, mentality, materiality. With formations as condition, consciousness. So it was said. Now, bhikkhus, does consciousness have formations as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case? Consciousness has formation as condition, venerable sir, thus we take it in this case. With formations as condition, consciousness. With ignorance as condition, formations, so it was said. Now, bhikkhus, do formations have ignorance as condition or not? Or how do you take it in this case? Formations have ignorance as condition, venerable sir, thus we take it in this case. With formations as conditions, ignorance. So there isn't really anything new there to add to the previous one. It's just basically the same again. It's just that this time he's analyzing backwards, starting with the problem of aging and death, and going step by step, and finding that the ultimate cause, the ultimate problem that we have to solve is the problem of ignorance. And if you can solve ignorance or delusion or whatever you like to call it, only then do you actually solve the ultimate problem of aging, death, and suffering. And then we have a recapitulation of that one again. Good bhikkhus, so you say thus, and also I say thus. When this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises, that is. And then you have the whole sequence again. Okay, so before I go on to that sequence, I'll just briefly explain what this is about, this little saying, this little addition here. When this exists, that comes to be, with the arising of this, that arises. Now this little statement there occurs in several places in the suttas, and it always occurs together with dependent origination. So this is like a statement in brief which shows the links, the conditioning, how there is a link between each of the links independent arising. In other words, when it says, before it says, aging and death have birth as condition, well, what is meant by this word condition here? What does condition mean? And this is what this little thing here explains. It explains what condition means. So, the first one here, when this exists, that comes to be. Another way of translating that, which is probably more accurate to the text, is when this exists, that exists. It's actually a more direct translation here. So, in other words, when ignorance exists, kamma exists. If there is ignorance, there will also be the making of kamma, good or bad. That's what he's saying here. In other words, making of kamma is inherent in ignorance. You cannot have ignorance and not make kamma. These things are part and parcel of the same thing. So when this exists, that exists. One is inherent in the other one. With kamma, consciousness is inherent in kamma. If you're making kamma, there is going to be rebirth and consciousness in the future. It's inherent in the making of kamma. And so on, all the way down to aging and death. If there is ignorance, then aging and death in the future life is inherent in that ignorance. When there is ignorance, there will be death and suffering and everything else in the future life. These things are part and parcel of the same thing. So that is one way of understanding the conditioning here, which happens between each link in the Paticchasamuppada. And the other way, which is given here, is that with the arising of this, that arises. In other words, when one of these, whereas the first one is almost like a structural principle saying that each one will be there if the one before it exists, the next one is more like saying that in each instance, when one of them arises, then the one coming after it will arise. It's like a sequential thing, if you like. So here you have that when, for example, when if there is contact, well, you know that feeling will come, will arise soon after the contact. If contact arises, feeling will arise. When there is feeling, then craving will arise, unless you're an arahant. When there is craving, there will be clinging. When there is clinging, there will be being. You will make kamma again, and then there will be birth, etc. So one arising leads to the arising of the next one. So it's just two different ways of looking at the conditioning factors between each link of the Paticca-samuppada. One being like saying, when this exists, the other one exists. The other one showing directly, when one arises, the next one arises. The difference between the two is not all that great, I think. They're pretty much saying the same thing here. So that is the actual conditioning, how the conditioning happens. And then he goes on to recapitulate the 12 links. That is, with ignorance as condition, formations. With formations as condition, consciousness. With consciousness as condition, mentality, materiality. With mentality, materiality as condition, the sixfold base. With the sixfold base as condition, contact. With contact as condition, feeling. With feeling as condition, craving. With craving as condition, clinging. With clinging as condition, being. With being as condition, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Thus is the origin of this whole mass of suffering here. Everybody happy with that? Yeah? Okay, so we will go on. So that is the... We have just now shown how suffering arises in the world. What is like the structural process behind suffering, which makes suffering happening, starting with ignorance, and the whole structure which leads up to suffering. Yeah. And now what we're going to show, and that is like the second noble truth, if you like, because it shows us the cause of suffering coming all the way from ignorance. Now the next one here is the third noble truth, and this is the cessation mode of Paticca-samuppada. And this mode shows that when each one of these ceases, the next one ceases. So they arise, and they can also cease. So this is the cessation mode of the same sequence. So, but with the remainderless fading away and cessation of ignorance comes cessation of making kamma. With the cessation of making kamma comes the cessation of consciousness at rebirth. You don't get reborn. With the cessation of consciousness, there is a cessation of mentality, materiality. If there is no consciousness there, there can be no body and no mind arising in a new life. With the cessation of that mind and body, there can be no senses, no sixfold base. So they cease. With the cessation of all the senses, well, there can be no contact anymore because nothing to contact through. With the cessation of contact, there can no longer be any feeling because feeling depends on contact. With the cessation of feeling, there is no craving, because feeling is always what we crave for in life. With the cessation of craving, there is no more clinging and no more taking up. When we don't take up anything, we are not being anything in particular. We're not being a being which is creating kamma in the sensual world or in any other world. We don't have any existence in that sense anymore. And when we don't have that existence in the sense of making kamma, then there is no rebirth in the future. There's no rebirth in the future. There is no aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair. And that all ceases. And such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. Yeah? So each one of these ceases in turn, one following the next one. Yeah? And then we show the same thing in the reverse sequence again. Yeah? So we're starting with aging and death. So with the cessation of birth, there is the cessation of aging and death. So it was said. Now, bhikkhus, do aging and death cease with the cessation of birth or not? Or how do you take it in this case? Aging and death cease with the cessation of birth, venerable sir. Thus we take it in this case with the cessation of birth, cessation of aging and death. So again, this is like the practical thing here. You are actually analyzing this. You know that the problem is aging and death. You want to get rid of aging and death and suffering. So what do you have to get rid of to be able to get rid of aging and death? You have to get rid of birth. So this is just showing you what you have to get rid of step by step so as to get rid of the problem which is suffering. Going backwards, with a cessation of being, cessation of birth, with a cessation of clinging, cessation of being, with a cessation of craving, cessation of clinging, with a cessation of feeling, cessation of craving, with a cessation of contact, cessation of feeling, with a cessation of the sixfold base, cessation of contact, with a cessation of mentality, materiality, cessation of the sixfold base, with a cessation of consciousness, cessation of mentality, materiality, with a cessation of formations, cessation of consciousness, with a cessation of ignorance, cessation of formations. So it was said, now bhikkhus, do formations cease with a cessation of ignorance or not? Or how do you take it in this case? Formations cease with a cessation of ignorance, venerable sir. Thus we take it in this case, with a cessation of ignorance, cessation of formations. So in this way we can see what we have to do. What we have to do is we have to make, we have to end ignorance. We have to give rise to understanding and wisdom, which is the opposite of ignorance. And when we give rise to that understanding and wisdom, then this whole thing unravels. It all ceases, all the way up to death, all the way up to aging and death. So this is what this shows us. Then we have the recapitulation on cessation. Good bhikkhus, so you say thus, and I also say thus. When this does not exist, that does not exist. Or come to be, he has here, but I say that does not exist. With a cessation of this, that ceases. In other words, when there is no ignorance, then then there is no karma formation. This is like a structure of things. This is inherent in things, that when ignorance disappears, you're not making any karma anymore. If you're not making any karma, then consciousness cannot re-arise in a future life. This is impossible. This is a structure of things, that when karma does not exist, then consciousness also cannot exist in a future life, etc., etc., all the way up to death. So death and suffering. So essentially, when there is no ignorance, then there can be no death and birth and death in a future life. And then the other way again, with the cessation of this, that ceases. So this shows you how from the cessation of ignorance, which we just saw now, each of these steps in the Paticca-samuppada, each of them ceases one by one, all the way up to the cessation of aging and death and suffering. So that is, with the cessation of ignorance come the cessation of formations, with the cessation of formations, cessation of consciousness. With the cessation of consciousness, cessation of mentality, materiality. With the cessation of mentality, materiality, cessation of the sixfold base. With the cessation of the sixfold base, cessation of contact. With the cessation of contact, cessation of feeling. With the cessation of feeling, cessation of craving. With the cessation of craving, cessation of clinging. With the cessation of clinging, cessation of being. With the cessation of being, cessation of birth. With the cessation of birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. So that is the Paticca-samuppada, and that is the main, basically, the rest of the sutta also actually continues with Paticca-samuppada later on, but that is like the main sort of the way it is usually set out in the suttas. So this is the way you will always see it. The sutta goes on a little bit more. I think if some people have to leave or you want to leave, please feel free to do so. Because I realize I'm going to go over a little bit over time today, because the sutta is so long. So don't feel shy about leaving. If you must leave or you feel like leaving, please do so. But I will, for those who want to, I will keep going until I finish this. Okay, so that is that. Now we move on to something which is related to this. Bhikkhus, knowing and seeing in this way, would you run back to the past thus? Were we in the past? Were we not in the past? What were we in the past? How were we in the past? Having been what did we become in the past? No, venerable sir. Okay. Knowing and seeing in this way, well, in this way here refers back to the Paticca-samuppada, right? Knowing and seeing again refers to stream entry here. Because you have full understanding and knowledge of Paticca-samuppada, then would you think like this? Were we in the past? Were we not in the past? All these things. No, you wouldn't. Why is that? And the reason why that is because you have all of these things are like speculations about the past. You know, all religions talk about the past to some extent. Some religions say that we came from nothing, we're created by God. Others say that we weren't created by God, we just arose spontaneously somewhere. And some religions say that after death we pass away, we go to hell or to heaven or whatever. But all of those speculations cease because you have seen for yourself what actually is happening. And what is happening is Paticca-samuppada. You arise through conditions, you arise through causes. And this is how consciousness and birth happens. So you have unraveled this already. You have seen for yourself exactly how rebirth happens. You know about the past. You understand the past. You understand the structure of samsara, so to speak. And you also understand about the future. Because the future is exactly the same. It will also happen through Paticca-samuppada, unless you overcome all this by becoming an arahant. So that's why you don't think about these things anymore, because you understand the past now. There is no need anymore to go speculating about these things. You have seen for yourself. You know exactly how it is. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you run forward to the future thus? Shall we be in the future? Shall we not be in the future? What shall we be in the future? How shall we be in the future? Having been what shall we become in the future? No, Venerable Sir. And again, there's no need to speculate about whether you're going to go to heaven or go to hell or whatever, whether it's permanently in heaven or permanently in hell or what, because you have seen that it happens in accordance with the rising. And you know that if you make good karma, you will go to a pleasant place. If you make bad karma, you will likely go to an unpleasant place. And you understand that these things happen according to cause and effect. And there is no God, or there is nothing, no kind of intelligence in the universe which orders you and puts you into one place or another. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you now be inwardly perplexed about the present? Am I? Am I not? What am I? How am I? Where has this being come from? Where will it go? No, Venerable Sir. And again, it is because Paticca-samuppada shows you that there is no... It shows you how rebirth happens without a self, how it's just cause and conditions happening. And because it shows that, because you have seen through this idea that there isn't a self, that there just is cause and conditions, you don't really have any perplexity about yourself anymore. You don't wonder who you are or who you are not, etc. You know exactly that there's just a process. And that process is what you took to be you before you became a Sotapanna. Bhikkhus, knowing and seeing in this way, would you speak thus? The teacher is respected by us. We speak as we do out of respect for the teacher. No, Venerable Sir. And the reason here, it's not that the monks don't respect the Buddha, obviously. That's not the point. The point is simply that they know and have seen for themselves. So they speak due to their own knowledge and vision, rather than just due to respect in the Buddha himself. And this is the point that's being made here. We speak, we see for ourselves, and that's why we don't speak simply out of respect. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you speak thus? The recluse is a name for the Buddha, so the recluse is the Buddha. The recluse says this, and we speak thus at the bidding of the recluse. No, Venerable Sir. They see what they have found. They have found the truth. They have found reality. They have discovered the truth according to the way things are. They have seen it for themselves. There's no point anymore in speaking out of respect for anybody else or because you want to do the bidding of somebody else. You know and you see for yourself. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you acknowledge another teacher? No, Venerable Sir. Again, it is because you have seen the Dhamma. And as it says in other suttas, when you have seen the Dhamma, you have also seen the Buddha, because the Buddha and the Dhamma are two sides of the same coin, because the Buddha is the one who has awakened to the Dhamma. He teaches the Dhamma. And you understand that the Dhamma that the Buddha has been teaching you all this time, you understand that that is what you have been awakening to. That's what you have awoken to, rather. And because of that, you can never take another teacher. Because you realize that the Buddha is doing exactly what he has done, exactly what you have done, except that the Buddha did it before you. Knowing and seeing in this way, would you return to the observances, tumultuous debates, and auspicious signs of ordinary recluses and Brahmins, taking them as the core of the holy life? No, venerable sir. You don't debate anymore because you've seen the truth. No point in debating anymore. You know the truth. In fact, one of the characteristics of the Sotapanna is that he is unshakable, in the sense that no matter how much you debate with the Sotapanna, he cannot be shaken in a sense of feeling anxiety or fear that he's going to lose the argument or anything, because he has seen the truth. You cannot shake a Sotapanna anymore emotionally. He is solid like a rock. And this is one of the characteristics of the Sotapanna. And of course, returning to observances here, this is like the attachment to rites and rituals which you have, which you give up when you become a Sotapanna. You don't have any attachment to rites and rituals anymore. So you don't do all these kind of observances which people of other sects do. And auspicious signs, I think, is probably just another of these looking for auspicious signs. Is obviously the exact opposite of having seen reality. You see in reality, you know how things work. There's no point in auspicious signs anymore. You just have to do karma, practice the Eightfold Path, and make an end of suffering. And you understand that. Do you speak only of what you have known, seen, and understood for yourselves? Yes, venerable sir. Good bhikkhus, so you have been guided by me with this Dhamma, which is visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading, to be experienced for the wise for themselves. For it was with reference to this that it has been said, bhikkhus, this Dhamma is visible here and now, immediately effective, inviting inspection, onward leading, and to be experienced by the wise for themselves. So here the Buddha again seems to be referring back to the Paticca-samuppada, and he's saying here that this Dhamma is visible here and now. In other words, it is possible to see Paticca-samuppada in this life, right? You can see it here and now. You don't have to wait till after death or anything like that, which you have in some other religions. It's immediately effective. Again, this is akalika. It's not bound up with time. So you can see it in this life again. It is not going to happen in the future. And this is, again, both of these things are the beautiful things in Buddhism, that we actually don't depend on some kind of external agency to tell us what the truth is, but we can actually find it right here and right now if we put in the effort. At least in theory we can do that. In practice, obviously, it's not going to be everybody who does it. Inviting inspection, ehi pasiko, literally come and see for yourself. That's what that Pali word means. Onwards leading, well, once you understand the Paticca-samuppada, you understand that with the cessation of ignorance, ultimately, the whole suffering ceases. Well, then you understand how that ceasing of ignorance leads onwards. To be experienced by the wise for themselves. The wise here may be a word for the Aryas who understand what is happening here. So you can see here how this phrase, this is what we chant so every so often when we do the homage to the Dhamma, visible here now, sandittiko, akaliko, ehipasiko, opanaiko, pachatang vinyuhi, veditabo. That's what that phrase is. And you can think of that when you think about this. It actually means here the understanding of the Paticca-samuppada. So it's a very profound thing which you can uncover in this Dhamma. Okay. The round of existence, conception to maturity. Bhikkhus, the descent, and this I should actually say here, that what is coming up now is basically a practical or a real example of Paticca-samuppada, how it actually happens in real life. Because obviously this is not just a theory, this is what actually happens in life, right? And this is to give a more down-to-earth and practical example of this. Because the descent of the embryo takes place through the union of three things. Here, there is the union of mother and father, but the mother is not in season, and the Gandhaba is not present. In this case, no descent of an embryo takes place. The Gandhaba here is just like a person who is going to be reborn, right? Like the consciousness of the mind, or somebody who is waiting to get established themselves in a new body, so to speak. And that new body, of course, is just that being which is just being conceived. So it's interesting here to note that the Gandhaba has to be there. If there is no mind or consciousness waiting to be reborn, then there cannot be any conception, because that is one of the necessary factors of conception. Which means, of course, that in Buddhism, we assume that there is consciousness from the very beginning of a pregnancy. In this case, no descent of an embryo takes place. Here, there is the union of mother and father, and the mother is in season, but the Gandhaba is not present. In this case, too, no descent of the embryo takes place. Again, you can see how the crucial factor in this case is the mind of another being, the consciousness. But when there is the union of mother and father, and the mother is in season, and the Gandhaba is present, through the union of these three things, the descent of the embryo takes place. So descent of the embryo just means that an embryo can establish itself in the womb. That's really all it means. The mother then carries the embryo in her womb for 9 or 10 months with much anxiety as a heavy burden. Then, at the end of 9 or 10 months, the mother gives birth with much anxiety as a heavy burden. Then, when the child is born, she nourishes it with her own blood, for the mother's breast milk is called blood in the Noble One's discipline. When he grows up and his faculties mature, the child plays at such games as toy plows, tip cats, somersaults, toy windmills, toy measures, toy cars, and toy bow and arrow. When he grows up and his faculties mature even more, the youth enjoys himself provided and endowed with the 5 cores of sensual pleasures, with forms cognizable by the eye, sounds cognizable by the ear, odors cognizable by the nose, flavors cognizable by the tongue, tangibles cognizable by the body, that are wished for, desired, agreeable and likely, connected with sensual desire and provocative of lust. So what we are seeing here is you can see the dependent origination happening here. You have the Gandhaba, which is the consciousness of a past life. It is present. It is what makes it possible for an embryo to arise in the womb and to attach itself to the womb. So you have the Gandhaba causes the descent of the embryo. So the embryo there is this mentality, materiality we're talking about before, together with consciousness. Then when that child grows up, we see how his faculties mature. All of this means, of course, that he or she gets all the senses and everything matures up. And then when the senses mature, you start seeing things and hearing things. And all of these things gives rise to vedana, to feeling. And these feelings are desired for an agreeable, likable, connected with sensual desire. And of course, that is how craving arises. So here you see how this paticca samuppada actually plays out in reality, in real life. On seeing a form with the eye, he lusts after it, if it is pleasurable. He dislikes it, if it is unpleasing. He abides with mindfulness of the body unestablished, with a limited mind, and he does not understand as it actually is, the deliverance of mind and the deliverance by wisdom, wherein those bad, unwholesome states cease without remainder. Okay. So you see here, this is craving arising here. He desires it or lusts after it if it's pleasing. In other words, he craves for anything which is pleasing. And he has aversion and negativity. He dislikes it if it is unpleasing, right? So there's a lot of things happening in his mind, craving and disliking happening in his mind. And because these things are happening in his mind, then he does not have this mindfulness which we are all trying to get, because he's always being overrun by likes and dislikes. So mindfulness is not established. And mindfulness of the body is one of those basic mindfulnesses that we always try to establish. Basically, knowing what you're doing at the time, whether you're walking around or sitting around. You have a sense for yourself and where your body is at and what you're doing. That's the mindfulness of the body, right? It's a basic kind of mindfulness, at least in its early stages, which we're trying to establish. And if you have too much disliking and liking, your mind is going to be all over the place and you won't have that mindfulness of the body. Moreover, you have a limited mind. You have a limited mind because you're overcome by aversions, by negativities, and by pleasures and desires and all these things. And a mind which is overcome by negativity and pleasures and all things is not a mind which is like can go into a jhana or can go into deep meditation, a mind which can have pure loving kindness or compassion for any beings. You can't have that because you're overcome by the five hindrances. By sensual desire and ill will, etc. This is the nature if you always follow after your desires and in this way. So an unlimited mind is always the mind of a jhana mind or the mind of the Brahma Viharas like metta and compassion, etc. And he does not understand as it actually is the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom. And this understanding is the understanding of the Sotapanna. So again, you come back to the Aryas here. If you haven't got, if you're messing around too much with sensual desire, you don't have mindfulness, you don't have samadhi through jhanas or through Brahma Viharas, then you cannot understand things as they actually are. And what you're not understanding is where there is liberation from suffering, basically. And that, of course, is the deliverance by wisdom and also the deliverance by mind. So you can see here, in a sense, you can almost like see here the whole gradual training here. You can see here, step by step. First of all, seeing the form with the eye, he sees it as pleasing, and he sees it as unpleasing. This is the lack of sense restraint, right? He doesn't have sense restraint here. Because he doesn't have sense restraint, he doesn't have mindfulness. Because he doesn't have mindfulness, he doesn't have samadhi. He doesn't have concentration of mind. He doesn't have any good meditation. Because he doesn't have any good meditation, he doesn't have the wisdom to see where the deliverance of mind is, where suffering stops. So this is like the whole gradual training there in a negative sense. Engaged as he is in favoring and opposing, whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant or painful, or neither pleasant nor painful, he delights in that feeling, welcomes it, and remains holding to it. So, obviously, because he is engaged, as it says, in favoring and opposing, it means that he is into feelings. He cares about what he feels. He is always concerned about feelings, whether they are sensual feelings or other feelings. So he is overcome by these things, and he holds on to these feelings, and he grasps hold of them. And as he does so, delight arises in him. He delights in happy feelings, right, in good feelings, and he non-delights in the bad feelings. Now, delight in feeling is clinging. Because delighting in feeling, then you are taking things up. You are deciding to take a particular course, indulging in sensuality or whatever, because of that delight in the feelings, because you want those positive feelings. So you take them up, you cling to them. So delight in feeling is clinging. With his clinging as condition, being comes to be. With being as condition, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. So you see here what happens to this person. You see going all the way from consciousness all the way to suffering and aging and death, like a practical example here. And then, of course, the same thing happens no matter which sense you go through. So on hearing a sound with the ear, on smelling an odor with the nose, on tasting a flavor with the tongue, on touching a tangible with the body, on cognizing a mind object with the mind, he lusts after it if it is pleasing. He dislikes it if it is unpleasing. Now delight in feeling is clinging. With this clinging as condition, being comes to be. Being as condition, birth. With birth as condition, aging and death. Sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair come to be. Such is the origin of this whole mass of suffering. Okay, I'll just keep going. So that is the. This is how suffering comes to be in practicality. Now this now comes a practical example of the ending of suffering. This is how suffering actually ends. Here, monks, a Tathagata appears in the world, accomplished, fully enlightened. And then it continues with the gradual training, with virtue, with sense restraint, and all the way up to the abandoning of the five hindrances. He purifies his mind from doubt there, as the abandoning of the last of the five hindrances. So here is somebody who is now practicing the path of the Tathagata, and he has come up to the point where he has abandoned the five hindrances. Having thus abandoned these five hindrances, imperfections of the mind that weaken wisdom, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, he enters upon and abides in the first jhana. He enters upon and abides in the second jhana, the third jhana, and then the fourth jhana, which has neither pain nor pleasure and purity of mindfulness due to equanimity. So this is the path then, which is, goes the opposite direction, which doesn't lead to suffering. And this is like the practical example of how the cessation happens. So on seeing a form with the eye, he does not lust after it if it is pleasing. He does not dislike it if it is unpleasing. He abides with mindfulness of the body established, with an immeasurable mind, and he understands as it actually is the deliverance of mind and the deliverance by wisdom wherein those unwholesome states cease without remainder. So at this point he has become an Arya. He has become at least a Sotapanna, a noble person, because he has that understanding of the deliverance of mind, the deliverance by wisdom, which only the Aryas have. So the implication here is that those jhanas up there, they also implied there is that he has become at least a stream enter at the same time. And this is what happens when you're a stream enter. This is how you practice. You don't lust after what is pleasing and what is unpleasing. You have mindfulness of the body. Your mind is immeasurable because you're practicing these jhanas. And you have this understanding of what you have to do to end all suffering, to get this deliverance by wisdom and the deliverance by mind. Having thus abandoned opposing and favoring, whatever feeling he feels, whether pleasant or painful, or neither painful nor pleasant, he does not delight in that feeling. He does not welcome it or remain holding to it. As he does not do so, delight in feeling ceases in him. With the cessation of his delight comes the cessation of clinging. In other words, he realizes that all this favoring and opposing feelings is useless. It doesn't get you anywhere. It just stops you from becoming enlightened. It goes in the wrong way, so you abandon these things. And when you abandon these things, you abandon clinging. When you abandon clinging, you have a cessation of being. With a cessation of being, cessation of birth. With a cessation of birth, aging and death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair all cease. Such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. And then you have exactly the same for the other five senses. And for each one of them, all the way down, such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering, when you don't delight in these things, when you don't favor and oppose feelings, you don't delight in them, you don't cling, you get the cessation of being, cessation of birth, cessation of aging and death, and cessation of suffering. So that is Patita Samuppada in the reverse sequence, whereby by seeing and understanding as it actually is, the deliverance of mind and deliverance by wisdom, this is the arising, this is where avidya, ignorance, starts to end, right? When you see things like that, avidya becomes undermined. And because avidya becomes undermined, you don't do those kamma formations anymore. Not doing those kamma formations means that you don't favor and oppose anymore. And by not favoring opposing, this whole sequence of paticca samuppada unravels, and you end dukkha, you end aging and death and dukkha. Okay, conclusion. Bhikkhus, remember this deliverance in the destruction of craving as taught in brief by me here. But remember the Bhikkhusati, son of a fisherman, as caught up in a vast net of craving, in the trammel of craving. That is the interesting thing here, is that he says here that the reason why this Sati, son of a fisherman, had this idea was obviously because of craving. He wanted there to be a self, and that is why he took consciousness to be permanent. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. Okay. Any comments or questions? It's a very long discourse, and it's a bit much for one session, but there you are anyway. So, okay, let's pay respect to a triple gemma.